Hello. Hi. My name is Joseph Lindenblad, and I have the honor and privilege to introduce my Rav for a long time. A little bit about the Rebbe. He got smicha from the yeshiva, and I know the Rav for a couple of years. Been on the Brooklyn scene. Currently the director of a foreign student program at the Bar Ilan University in Israel. He gets shiurim there regularly. He gets shiurim in Shalavim in the OU Israel Center. He's a Rebbe in the Givat Zev community. And we published 10 books, all which are Gevaldik. And he has a lot of articles online, which are also geschmack. But besides all that, I think the biggest thing about Rav Kahn is really what he provides to the Talmidim in Bar Ilan. See, for myself, when I came to Bar Ilan, I think it wasn't what we're holding at such a high level. But, you know, just being in the presence of such a Talmud Chacham really makes you think about putting a new light and really just want you to aspire to grow in your Torah. But you realize the richness and the depthness of this Torah and the Torah for all of us. So, without further ado, very good time.
Okay. So I really do hope that whatever I say today will be developed in Gishmah and anything else that you may have indicated.
So somebody asked me before, you know, if this year's students are as good as last year's students. So I said, no. I said, last year's was better. Then they said, what about 2 years ago? So the truth is, I don't remember. I don't. It's sort of all of melds together year after year after year. And please appreciate, I've been doing this a long time. Friday night, I was invited to speak someplace. We were in San Diego for Shabbos, and I spoke there. And then they had an Onik Shabbos in someone's house. And the fellow there tells me, oh, by the way, my daughter was a student of yours in Bar Ilan. I said, what year? And he starts doing the math. It turns out 2004. She was my student. So if you're going to ask me, so how was her year compared to last year? Well, time sort of gets confused over time, which is actually what my topic is. And being that YU is a place that we discuss Torah Umada, so I wanted to start with, I want to do something having to do with Torah Umada, and then I'll get to my topic, and somehow it may actually make sense. If it doesn't, then, but I want to explain something about how all of Sefer Shmot works. But in order to do that, I want to read one or two quotes which are as obscure as could possibly be. I won't quote right now who's speaking, but he writes as follows. Actually, he's quoted. The ones have the breakup of time, where there is no time, trying to make the focus as strong as a magnifying glass under the sun. Do that consciously is a trick. And then now some of you will understand who I'm talking about. And I did it on Blood on the Tracks for the first time. I knew how to do it because of the technique I'd learned. I actually had a teacher for it. So those of you who have no idea what Blood on the Tracks are, just as an indication of failed education. But what's really interesting here is Bob Dylan, Robert Zimmerman, Shapsai Zissel Ben Avraham, that he said he had a teacher who taught him something about how to do something with time. He goes on to explain that before his motorcycle accident, he was able to write without thinking about it. And then afterwards, he had some kind of an amnesia, which he says is either physical or metaphysical, and he lost his ability to write, till his teacher taught him how to write. So I'll just mention who his teacher was, and then I'm going to explain what happened and what he did, and why perhaps this is important for us to be able to understand Sefer Shmos. There was somebody who actually lived in New York for a part of his life, whose name was Solomon Nachumovich Rabinovich, who no one knows by his real name. His pen name is actually very well known. His pen name is Shalom Aleichem. Shalom Aleichem's name, Solomon Nachumovich, he was called Nachumovich because that was his father's name, was Nachum, and then he sort of threw that into your name. So he had a son named Nachum, who then changed his name to Norman. Norman changed Rabinovich to Rabin, and Norman became Norman Rabin. Norman Rabin was a painter and a philosopher, and he was Bob Dylan's teacher in painting. And he said that after he met Norman Rabin, he learned how to paint, but he also learned how to write. But I just want to explain what he is saying, and then we'll see how this applies to, as I said, at least Sefer Shmos, maybe all of Chumash, but definitely Sefer Shmos. So let me explain. When we think, and now let's be honest, all of us think in different ways at different times. We don't think consistently. There are times we're very critical, and there are times that we sort of flow. How many of you have family members, when they start telling the story, they get lost? Right? Do you know exactly what I'm saying? They get lost? How do they get lost? Tell me.
They think of one story, and then it has to do with something else, and then they get into that story.
And then they go...
And then they go back and forth, and then someone totally else, and it's all over the place.
Right. And you know what was interesting? If Bible critics were to analyze that, they would say there were four different authors. I don't know if anybody appreciated what I just now said. But that's because sometimes we think critically. And when do we think critically? We think critically about certain things. But we know how to tell stories. And when we tell stories, telling stories, you can't always tell a story in the exact way that things happened. Should I tell you the story of how I met my wife? It's not important for today. You want to hear? You don't want to hear.
Yeah.
I had a friend who convinced me that I had to drop over and say mazel tov to somebody who was having a sweet 16. I said, I can't go, only a girl's there. He goes, we'll go in for 1 minute. We went in. She saw me. She hit on me. She asked me my phone number. That's what happened. Now, I can't start telling the story like that. I have to start telling the story in a completely different way. By the way, this should give some of you hope. Actually, it shouldn't. But we don't tell stories in a direct way. So now, should the Chumash be a story which is told in a direct way? Those of you who've learned a little bit are actually going to have a bit of a disadvantage in what I'm going to say now. I'm right now paraphrasing one of the Rishonim who says that, of course, when you tell over stories, you have to tell over a story out of sequence because that's how it works. I'll just tell you who says that. That's the Ramban. And the reason why it's important, because the Ramban is generally cited as being the person who says that the Torah should be in the proper sequence. Well, it's not really what he says. He says the Torah is in the proper sequence unless there's a reason not to. And you know what a good reason not to is, according to the Ramban? Sometimes when you tell a story. There's two times in Bereishit that the Ramban will admit to this easily. One time will be, first is death of Avraham, the second time is death of Yitzchak. Why? By the time that Avraham dies, how old are his grandchildren? Probably around 15 years old. But Avraham, we're told about Avraham's death long before then. Avraham's death was told long before his children, his grandchildren were even born. But you just have to do the math and realize that Avraham lives another X amount of years. And it's very simple math, and you realize he's still alive. But the Ramban will say, well, that's not how you tell stories. You tell the story about Avraham's life and his death, and then you start the story of Yitzchak, but it doesn't always have to be in sequence because that's not how you tell stories. Same thing is true in terms of the death of Yitzchak. Yitzchak lives all the way through to the sale of Yosef, but we're told about his death long before. Those of you maybe remember a Rashi that says that his father mourned, and his father was clear who the father is. Rashi says, no, it's Yitzchak mourns for Yaakov for not knowing that Yosef is really alive for Yaakov's mourning, but he doesn't have to mourn because he's still alive. Those are a couple of instances where the Ramban is not troubled at all. And the Ramban knows that the Torah is not in proper sequence because that's how you tell the story sometimes. Now, you, all of you, have no problem with anything that I've said. And you didn't need Bob Dylan and you didn't need Norman Rabin for this because, Baruch Hashem, you've all watched enough television and seen enough movies and you know about character development and you've seen multiple characters being developed at once and it doesn't bother you at all. Because that's the world that you were raised in. But what's interesting, some of you may get confused, and maybe even when you read the Chumash, you'd say, hold it, this is out of sequence, and who's the author, and what's going on over here? Well, it could be just like your mother, who tells stories in a way, because that's how you tell stories. Now, the book of Shmos has a number of things which are out of sequence. I'm saying it like that, or maybe I shouldn't. Okay, there's at least one which is out of sequence, and I don't want anyone to argue with me about this, because you can't. There are other things which become a question whether it's out of sequence or not, and you know what happens? It actually changes the story. Because it's not just that how I tell the story, it becomes a different story, and that's what I'm going to try to illustrate as we move on. And there are a number of different examples that I can use, but I want to start with the example that, as far as I'm concerned, you can't argue with me. So what's the one example that no one can argue with? Anyone knows? Yes?
I think maybe, I'm not sure, but when Yitro heard
So that's good. That's good. One Yitro heard it, but that's one of the things which is subject to debate. That's not a slam dunk. Where's Simcha? If Simcha's too busy with basketball, he couldn't come tonight. His class? Okay. Tell him that I was looking for him. There's actually a situation prior to that. When Yitro comes, there's an argument what happened when he came. The second part of the argument is a little bit afterwards when it says that Vayihimi Macharat. Rashi says Vayihimi Macharat when he sees Moshe sitting around all day dealing with judgment. So according to Rashi, it's the day after Yom Kippur. Okay, I'm sorry for doing this because I did this enough times during the year and I confused all of you and you're going to have this glazed look over your eyes right now. So I truly apologize for this. The Jews got out of Egypt on Pesach. 50 days later, they stood at Herz Sinai. 40 days later was the sin of the golden calf. That's 90 days, 3 months after they left Egypt. Very simple. Which means they leave in the early spring. 3 months later, it'll take you to the very beginning of summertime. We're not at Yom Kippur yet. Rashi just now said that the beginning of Yitro tells us an event that took place after Yom Kippur. The Ramban then asks, which Yom Kippur? The first year or the second year? He was busy the first year. What are you talking about? And the Ramban critiques this. But Rashi says, yeah, this is after Yom Kippur, which means why or how is Moshe judging people all day if there's no content to judge them with? There has to be content. They needed to have accepted the Torah already. If you don't have the Torah, how can Moshe judge people? So Rashi says that obviously the beginning of Parshat Yitro, when Moshe comes and Moshe's watching, took place when? It took place way later after Matan Torah. So that's the opinion of Rashi. We'll leave the Ramban now, because the Ramban would really prefer everything goes in sequence, but that wasn't the slam dunk. What was the one that you can't argue with? Which, if you've never noticed it, is just so obvious that there's nothing to do about it. It was actually a little bit before that. It was back in chapter 16, Perek Tet Zayin, where it starts talking about the man, and it says that Moshe instructs to take some of the man and to put it in a jar. But for what? Well, you would a time capsule. To take it and put it in a time capsule. And then he says where to place the time capsule. He says to place it, he says, Vayoma Moshe el Aron, kach tzin senet achat, v'ten shama meloha omer man, v'nachato lefnei Hashem, put it in front of God. Well, that's quite mysterious what in front of God means, or quite the opposite, what's not in front of God. L'mishmeret l'dor techem, it's a time capsule for generations. Kashit tziva Hashem el Moshe, as God prepared. And then it says, v'yenichu Aron lefnei ha'idut, l'mishmeret. He put it in front of the Eidut. What does the Eidut mean? Generally, the Eidut would be a term which would be used for the Mishkan. This is many, many chapters before there is a Mishkan. And if that didn't bother you enough, right afterwards it says, "V'nei Yisrael achlu taman arba'im shana," and the Jews ate man for the next 40 years. I hope you realize that that's a perspective of 40 years having gone by. Time doesn't seem to make that much of a difference over here. It's telling us a perspective of 40 years later. By the way, just to answer a simple question, I have no problem whatsoever that when God dictates the Torah to Moshe, he tells Moshe to write this down, and he had told him already then, take it, and then eventually to put it in the Mishkan, but it's telling this over here. So I'm just pointing out is that this verse clearly indicates a later perspective, and again, the Bible criticism really doesn't trouble me, as I hinted earlier. If you look at Rashi here, it indicates that it's referring to a time, which, just before I said the Rashi, after Moshe's dead, till they get to the land, they ate it until they get to the land of Israel, which means after Moshe won't be there anymore. And I have no problem with Moshe, the greatest of prophets, to tell us about something that hasn't happened yet, but that's a really interesting verse. That verse certainly indicates a time 40 years later, and just in case none of you understand what I'm talking about, why are they there for 40 years? Maybe because of the spies, or maybe because of the sin of the golden calf. Those are sins that haven't happened yet. There's no decision of 40 years. They're just a couple days away from the land of Israel. This didn't have to happen yet. And yet, nonetheless, the Torah is talking in a way where, I'll say it again, where time exists in an interesting fashion. Let me go back to Norman Raven. Let me go back to art. Let me go back to what Bob Dylan learned from his art teacher. Do you know what's interesting about art? I don't know if any of you are artists. But you can put on one piece of paper, you can put on one board, You can put somebody when they're very old, and somebody when they're very young, and someone when they're middle-aged, and you can put it all in one painting. A canvas can tolerate different aspects of time, and nothing bad is going to happen, which means it's not a sense of timelessness, it's a sense of multiple perspectives of time can exist together. And that's what he understood at that point. And therefore, if any of you ever did hear the song Tangled Up in Blue, will understand why they didn't understand it, because it deals with complete timelessness, the way that the story is being told over. And that's what Bob Dylan was saying. But let's get back to Shmos, because you can learn about Dylan from other people, maybe. A matter of fact, some of the Rishonim talk about this episode of Moshe and Yitro, the Chizkuni, for example, one of the Rishonim says, oh, that's the same episode in Sefer Bamidbar when Chovev goes away, which means he claims that first third of Bamidbar and chapter 18 of Shmot, oh, that's the same story. That's not two different stories. One could make that argument. There's a harder argument to make, which is made by the Bechor Shor. He claims that also in Bishalach, that when Moshe hits the rock now and Moshe hits the rock later, he says that's the same rock story. I know everyone else says, no, there's two rock stories. He says, no, what do you mean two rock stories? That's a little silly to claim there's two stories. But you're going to tell me, but they have two different endings to them. No, he goes, really, it's the same story being retold. First time we're being told very simply what happened, and the second time we told the full story, but that story really takes place at a later time. By the way, that Bechor Shor is very, very difficult. It's very difficult. He doesn't say it here. He says in Bamidbar. He goes, yeah, that's the same story that happened before. Not two different episodes. But let me get to things which are, again, going to be more interesting now. If you read Rashi carefully last week and read Rashi carefully this week, you realize that chapter 19 and chapter 24 deal with the same time period. The Seret HaDibrot are written in chapter 20. I'll make it easy for you. Chapter 19 is the chapter in Yitro last week leading up to Matan Torah, where they make all the preparations. Rashi, they will say, oh, that's the first day of the month, that's the second day of the month, that's the third day of the month, and so on. They eventually get the Torah either on the sixth or the seventh day of the month, depending who you ask. You get to chapter 24, more preparations to receive the Torah. And Rashi here says, also, we're there in those first couple of days, and it's before Matan Torah. It's before the Seret HaDibrot, even though the Seret HaDibrot are written in chapter 20. So if you follow Rashi, you're completely confused. If you want to stick to a commentary, it will be really easy. It's the Ramban. Everything's just the way that it's written. For Rashi, all of Matan Torah is convoluted, confused, out of sequence, and of course the question is going to be why. I'll tell you why soon as we move on. Not only that, immediately after the Ten Commandments were written, Aseret Dibrot, according to Rashi, they only heard two of them. So that's also out of sequence. They hear two of them, they stop. God, please, Moshe, stop God from speaking. Then Moshe goes back and says, no, you really should hear it. Then God says the other eight to Moshe, who goes back and says, so again, you have things out of sequence, the way that they're told in chapter 20 itself. Moving to chapter 24, we have, well, actually, this is going to be really significant. At some point, the Jews are going to say, Na'aseh v'nishma. Right? What is the significance of Na'aseh v'nishma? Or to translate, Na'aseh, we will do. V'nishma, we will listen or continue to listen. What's the background of the Na'aseh v'nishma? So hold on for that for a second. Rashi will continue to do this to us another time. Rashi will claim in chapter 31 at the very end, which is right when Moshe's handed the tablets, right before they sin with the golden calf, he'll say that this actually happened way before. And therefore, I'm sorry if you're not with me, from chapter 25 to chapter 31, or all out of sequence as far as Rashi is concerned, that's the instruction to build the Mishkan. Rashi claims that 25 to 31 should have happened after chapter 32, because 32 tells about the sin of the golden calf, which happened prior to the instructions to build the Mishkan. The Ramban thinks that's absolutely not the case. So again, what I'm trying to point out is, depending on who you're talking to, the whole sequence of Sefer Shemot is incredibly different. Again, according to Rashi, you can make an argument, and I think it's a mistake, to say had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there would not have been a Mishkan. So why do I think that's a mistake? Well, one thing is I don't know what to do with our time capsule. Time capsules are mentioned beforehand. So you say, no, but that was really mentioned afterwards, and I'm getting myself into a loop. If you read the Uz Yashir properly, as you should every single day, it also makes references to come to God's holy mountain, and talks about a place which is a holy place. So it means the people intuited all the way back by the crossing of the sea, that they're going to be coming and building a Beit HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, is this simply an accident? So again, I'll explain what I think. I think had they not, and listen carefully, because otherwise you'll say I've contradicted myself again. I think had they not sinned with the golden calf, there never would have been a Mishkan. But there would have been a Beit HaMikdash. Why wouldn't there have been a Mishkan? Because they would have gone directly to Eretz Yisrael. You don't need a temporary place of holiness. Right? When do you... It's like a couple who were... You rent a place because you weren't able to save the money to buy a place yet. Yes? That doesn't mean that the Jews were supposed to come directly... For some of you, do not pass go, do not collect to, if you even know about such things. Go directly to Eretz Yisrael and build... Okay, imagine this for a moment. No sin of the golden calf. No sin of the spies. If you want to imagine as well, no sin of hitting the rock. So they go directly from Har Sinai. They come down from Har Sinai. What holiday was that supposed to be? What holiday? Moshe, they come down. What holiday was it supposed to be? They got everything right except for one thing. They were singing, right? It says they were eating and they were drinking and they were dancing and they were singing and they were, and so on. So what did they get wrong? They only got one little thing wrong. What was that? That they were doing all this around the golden calf. They were supposed to do this around Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes? And you know what's really interesting? When we're told that when Moshe eventually comes down, they can't look at him because Moshe glows. Moshe glows as if his face, as if he's like the sun. And he's compared to that various midrashim, as if Moshe is like a golden calf, as it were. They danced around the wrong thing. Can you imagine Moshe comes down? It's Simchas Torah. They were eating and they were drinking and they were dancing. What day do you think it was? It was Simchas Torah. And what made it Simchas Torah? Because Moshe just came down from the mountain with the Torah. They're supposed to have Simchas Torah. But what was the sin? The sin is that they're singing and dancing from the Egel Azav. They went to the wrong party. Naomi, I went to the right party. I wasn't invited. I crashed, but I went to the right party. The Jews went to the wrong party. They danced around the golden calf. That was the mistake. So what happens if there's no golden calf? They dance around instead, Moshe with the Luchos. What happens next? They pack up, they leave, and where do they go? Directly to Eretz Yisrael. Who leads them? Moshe. What happens next? They build the Moshe. Everybody sees Moshe coming in. Everyone runs away. Everyone scatters away. And what happens next? Moshe builds the Beis HaMikdash. End of history. Moshe becomes Mashiach. That's it. The story's over. What we don't understand sometimes is that the sin of the golden calf is actually a sin where they... Okay, do you guys remember this midrash that they killed somebody that day? Who did they kill? Who did they kill? Chor. Who was Chor? Who was Chor? Chor came from which tribe? From the tribe of Yehuda. His grandson will eventually build the Mishkan. His grandson is Bezalel. Bezalel ben Uri ben Chor, the Shevet Yehuda. Chor was mentioned once before during the war against Amalek. He's holding up one of Moshe's arms and Aaron's holding up the other arm. This is really true. That who exactly that is, that's harder to say. I'm saying things which are straightforward and obvious. He's Bezalel's grandfather. That's clear. So you have somebody named Yehoshua from the tribe of Yosef, who is the prototype of Mashiach ben Yosef down below, fighting, defeating Amalek. You have Moshe, who represents Torah. You have Aaron, who represents the man who will be the Kohen Gadol. And you have Hur from Yehuda, the one who represents Malchut, kingdom, the man who would be king. He represents David. His grandson represents Shlomo. They killed the man who was supposed to be the Mashiach, which means they killed the concept of Mashiach. Actually, they did a lot of sins that day. They did Avodah Zarah, idolatry. Rashi says, they did Gilei Arayot, and they also did Shvichat Amim, they did murder. Which means instead of having Simchas Torah in a very wholesome way, they ended up committing the most severe sins imaginable. So guess what? There was once a song in Israel, Mashiach lo ba, Mashiach lo mitalfein, lo mitalfein. Shalom Chanoch. It was about the crash of the Israeli stock market, not what you think. But that was a refrain, Mashiach lo ba. There was no salvation. Everyone went bankrupt. That episode already tells us that something is not going to work out. Yes, now we need a Mishkan. And why do we need a Mishkan? Because we're going to be away from the lands of Israel for a long time. Okay, let me give you 1 minute Zionist talk. One minute. When someone builds a beautiful, nice shul in America, do you feel good or do you feel bad about it? You could feel. I understand why you'd feel good. I personally have mixed feelings because it's very good that you need shuls, you need schools, you need people, you need rabbis, you need to learn, and you need to move. You need to get out of here, and you're building on quicksand. And what in the world are you people doing? So, the building of the Mishkan is something which is temporary because they're in the wrong place, and they're in the wrong place because they're punished. But what happens if you can choose that you don't want to be punished? I don't know if that made any sense to any of you. You can say, no, I don't want to be punished. I don't want to build in quicksand. I want to pick up and I want to go where I need to go. But what happened at that point? They had to build the Mishkan. They had to build the Mishkan because they can't build the Beit HaMikdash. And why can't they build the Beit HaMikdash? And now everything is going to fall apart at this point. They're not going to go to the land of Israel, right, immediately. Moshe's never going to make it over there. And if Moshe doesn't make it over there, they're not going to build the Beit HaMikdash right away. Just like they sinned by the foot of Har Sinai, they're going to sin again. They're going to sin in Yerushalayim. They're going to do all kinds of things that, just like the Luchot are broken on the ground, the same thing that happens, the Beit HaMikdash should actually be destroyed. A Beit HaMikdash built by Moshe could not ever be destroyed. So all of that is part of this loop that has now taken place. Why? I know that you never thought that I would say this, because they didn't celebrate Simchat Torah properly. See, now you see how important Simchat Torah is? Again, I'll say it again. Properly. They ended up worshipping a golden calf instead of Moshe. Now let's get back, because we've just now touched this other issue. According to the Ramban, he can't possibly tolerate the concept that the Mishkan is an accident, and just because they sinned, and I'll say it again, I think he's overplaying his hand. I don't think that's what Rashi really means, but Rashi nonetheless says the building of the Mishkan comes after the sin. By the way, I'll explain to you the flip side of everything that I'm saying right now. In order to do that, I have to get back to the other thing, which is a question if it's in sequence or not, because all of these parts are interwoven and interrelated, as I hope now you understand. Remember I mentioned something called Naseh V'Nishma before? According to the Ramban, everything's in sequence. And if everything's in sequence, what did they say Naseh V'Nishma about? It's in chapter 24. What happened by chapter 24? They already heard the Aseret HaDibrot, chapter 20. They heard Parshat Mishpatim, chapter 21, 22, 23. Moshe taught this to them, and he reads them something called the Sefer HaBrit. And then they say, okay, Naseh V'Nishma. Do you realize the Ramban just now ruined Naseh V'Nishma? It's not like this great thing. I mean, I know when we're kids, we're all taught that God says to the Jews, you want to accept the Torah? Should I say something deep for you? So that, just in case, so you feel like you didn't waste your time coming up from Stern or Muncie? I'll say something deep. Do you remember the Midrash that says that God went to the nations of the world and offered them the Torah first? As they went over to Yishmael and says to Yishmael, sorry, first says Esav, actually. Esav, will you accept the Torah? And Esav says, what's written there? And God says, it says, hey, you shouldn't murder. And Esav says, no, thank you, can't do that. And then he goes to Yishmael and says, Yishmael, will you accept the Torah? What does it say in it? You shouldn't commit adultery. He says, no, I can't do that. Okay. This is not random. Why would it choose those two sins with these two people? Avraham teaches the world chesed. In Kabbalistic literature, there's something which is known as a klipa. A klipa means it's a cover, it's a shell, it's a veneer. Okay, can you imagine if you had a beautiful orange and you peel the whole orange perfectly that it still looks like an orange, but there's nothing inside? That's a klipa. And someone says, oh, I really want that orange. You take the orange, and you can eat the orange. Orange peel is not good, no matter what some people think. Orange peel is not good. An orange is good. But you've gone, you've confused the essence with the outside of it. According to, and Rashi cites this, and the Midrash cites this clearer, that Yishmael used Avraham's chesed as a pickup line. It says he would go over to women and say, oh, you're a follower of Avraham, don't you know that you have to perform chesed for me? And Yishmael was corrupt. And therefore, and chesed is also used later on in the Torah as an indication of inappropriate sexual relations. Regarding incest specifically, use the word chesed. It has the veneer of love, the veneer of kindness, the veneer of something good, but it's even worse than that shell of that orange because it's missing the essence. The essence always has to be there. So what Yishmael represents is the klipa, the outside of chesed, and that is inappropriate sexual relations. So therefore he's asked, what does it say? Don't commit adultery. No, I don't want that. Because he was very much into the whole veneer. Esav is the klipa of Yitzchak. Yitzchak is gvura. What is gvura? Gvura is strength. Real strength, we understand, is self-control. But he uses this outward veneer of strength, which is going and using your power on other people, which would end up being murder. So they say, no, we don't want this. Now, what's interesting about the Midrash, if you want to find it, you'll see that Rashi quotes it all the way at the end of Devarim, in Perek Lamed Gimel, when it talks in the Pasuk about that God comes from Seir and comes to Paran. Those two places are mentioned, and those are places mentioned in conjunction with Esav and with Yishmael. But I told you, I'm going to say something deep. Why is the sequence wrong? It should have been first Yishmael, and then it should have been Esav. Why does it tell us in the wrong sequence? So the Vilna Gaon, on his commentary to that Pasuk, to that verse, says that God offers it to them, and then Bnei Yisrael take the holiness that Yishmael and Esav have, the other way around, that Esav and Yishmael have, and the Jews say, Na'aseh v'nishma. Esav, Na'aseh. Yishmael, Nishma. Na'aseh v'nishma is the power of Esav, La'asot, the one who does, Esav, Asu, Na'aseh. Yishmael, Nishma. So therefore, this thought that God has to offer, give the Torah to them because they have power, but they choose not to use it. They choose to go after the veneer. So who's going to take the essence of the Na'aseh, the essence of the Shema, the spiritual potential of Yishmael, and the spiritual potential of Esav? That's what the Jews do when they say Na'aseh v'nishma. So now let me go back and say things on a simpler level. According to Rashi, and we were all brought up with Rashi, I hope, God says, you want the Torah? They don't ask anything. They don't ask what's written. Na'aseh v'nishma. So that's great. But then you look at the Ramban, and the Ramban says, no, they already heard all of this stuff. Now, just stop a second. If according to the Ramban, they already heard the Aseret Dibrot, and they already heard all of Parshat Mishpatim, at the end of Perek Kaf Dalet, Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. So what does he learn over those 40 days and 40 nights? He can't learn Mishpatim again. He already learned them. So according to the Ramban, what he will be learning during that time is presumably what's written next. And what's written next? Truma and Tetzaveh and so on, which means the building of the Mishkan. According to the Ramban, the building of the Mishkan is what they learned up there. Which is according to Rashi, at that point, when Moshe goes up, he learns Parshat Mishpatim, which means he learns Nezik and he learns damages, he learns interpersonal things, laws that deal with people. According to the Ramban, Moshe goes up for 40 days and he learns about the building of the Mishkan. Because according to the Ramban, everything's in sequence. According to Rashi, the sequence is completely inverted. Okay, I'm going to get to a point now. Hopefully that will then tie all of this in. Actually, the argument between Rashi and the Ramban, if you look at the Ramban, will tell you that it actually is sourced in a book called the Mechilta. And the Mechilta, there are three opinions. The three opinions I'm saying now, Rashi and the Ramban, and the third will be the Chizkuni, are not exactly the three opinions, they approximate them. But the Chizkuni says, when the Jews said Na'aseh v'nishma, what is it that Moshe had said to them that they agreed? So it says in the verse that Moshe reads to them the Sefer HaBrit. He reads to them this book of the covenant. So he says, oh, you don't want to know what the book of the covenant is? It's the covenant. Stop. What does it mean it's the covenant? He goes, it's the covenant which is recorded at the very end of the book of Vayikra, which means it's the Tochacha, it's Parshat B'chukotai. It's all of the implications of what happens if you don't follow the Torah. Which means, you know, I talk about Sefer Shemot not going in sequence. The Chizkuni just went far further than Rashi ever went. And but by the way, if according to Rashi, there's one verse, you can use this as a challenge question at home, you can ask any rabbi you want, it's not so hard, you can ask anyone. What one verse is written real time in three different books of the Chumash? Sorry, what verse? What date, what calendar date is real time in three different books? Happens on that day. End of Shemot, we get to Rosh Chodesh Nisan in year number 2. It's in Shemot. It's written in Vayikra, and it's written again in Bamidbar. Same date. We're at the same time. By the way, that's very hard to do when we think, because we think logically and we think critically and we think in sequence on a piece of paper, on a canvas, that could work. On a canvas, you can have the same day you know, again and again. In a movie, you can easily have it, and you have no problem whatsoever waking up every morning to the same day. That's not a problem. But when we read the Torah, hold it, how can we still be at the same day? Yeah, we're still at the same day. That day was an unbelievable day. That's the day of Nadav and Avihu. And that's written in Vayikra. And that's the end of Shemot. That's when the Mishkan is completed. And that's again going to be later on in Bamidbar. That same day, when the other Nesiim are mentioned as well, that same day is mentioned. But let me get back to the Chizkuni to understand this. There are three ways to look at Matan Torah, three ways to look at Naaseh v'Nishma. Rashi, leap of faith. Let's talk about marriage. Do you really think you're going to know the person before you get married? A little bit. A little bit. A little bit. How much? Can I 5%. Can I give you a hint? People, when they try to meet people, try to show their best part. Listen, I personally think that one of the worst things the Jewish community has ever come up with was the idea of separate seating at weddings. It's the craziest thing imaginable. You have a guy, it's like the one time all week he actually took a shower and tucked in his shirt. You have a girl who's wearing her nice clothing and putting on makeup and everything, and you say, no, but you guys can't sit together, because now is not the right, no, this is completely wrong. I mean, it's just for your shadchanim business, right? This is just total, total insanity. Getting married is going to be a certain leap of faith. You don't know everything. According to Rashi, the marriage between God and the Jewish people is a leap of faith. It's when we know very little, we don't know what we're getting ourselves into, but we're smitten. I don't know if you know that word. We're what?
What does that mean?
Forget about it. It's not for you. You think she's really hot. Okay, did that work? Okay. You're in love. You're in love, and you say, Naaseh v'Nishma. You know, whatever you want. Naaseh v'Nishma. Great, let's go. And Rashi is very romantic. But it's not just very romantic, because it's not just a marriage. It's theologically compelling. The Jews stand by Mount Sinai and say to God, Naaseh v'Nishma. Yes, let's do it. According to the Ramban, it's okay. You'll decide if it's less romantic or not, but they know exactly what they're getting into. Actually, according to the Ramban, this is part of what bothers him, it's a conversion. You can't have a conversion when somebody says, you accept the mitzvah. Sure, do you know what they are? I have no idea. Somebody converts, they accept the mitzvah. According to the Ramban, standing at our Sinai, the entire Jewish people converted to Judaism. So in order to convert to Judaism, you at least have to know the Ten Commandments. You have to at least have to know some of these interpersonal or relationship of man and God. You need to know something. You can't convert if you don't know anything. So the Ramban is saying, of course they had to know the laws, and therefore it's in order. They learned all of Parshat Mishpatim. They learned the Aseret Dibrot, and they accept the Torah at that point. So according to the Ramban, it's not as romantic as Rashi, but it's a little more practical. But do you realize what the Chizkuni just now did? Chizkuni said that they learned all of the mitzvah to that point, but they also learned what's called the Tochacha. You guys know what the Tochacha is? It's the rebuke which is written at the end of Vayikra, that if you don't do this, this is going to happen to you, and this is going to happen to you, and this is going to happen to you. Do you realize what the Chizkuni is saying? He's saying that Matan Torah included within it a prenup agreement telling you exactly what's going to happen if you break this marriage in any way. These are the punishments that you're going to get. And believe me, it's far worse than the OU or the RCA or anybody else's prenup that they've come up with so far, because it's the Tochacha and Vayikra. But according to the Chizkuni, the Jews at Har Sinai, you know, look Moshe in the eye and say, great, we accept. Naaseh v'Nishma. Which means it's not that one is better or one is worse or one is more romantic and one is less. It's three different ways of understanding what happened at Har Sinai. And all of this has to do with our problem of the sequence of the things and how they took place. According to Rashi, the Ramban, everything's in the right sequence, and therefore they know a little bit of information. They know some of the laws. Why? Because it's a conversion. According to Rashi, they don't know anything. Because he inverted the order, he inverted the sequence, and he's claiming that chapter 24 comes before chapters 20, 21, 22, and 23. So he stuck it back together with 19, so he says, therefore, the Jews know nothing, very romantic. Whatever you say, God, we're going to do. But the Chizkuni says that it's also, like Rashi, out of sequence, but he says, out of sequence, not only do they know everything in between, they actually know what's going to happen at the end of Vayikra already. God already told Moshe all of that, and he tells the people all of that, and they say, we don't care about the consequences, we accept this completely. Which means that this idea of accepting the Torah to them, they're going into it with 100% knowledge, they know what they're going into, and nonetheless they accept it. What I was trying to show today, it wasn't clear, is that the book of Shemot can be looked at in different ways. It could be looked at, as I said, following everything in its proper sequence, except for the things that you can say are proper sequence, like I pointed out back in chapter 16. It's very difficult to say that's in sequence because it talks about 40 years later. So other than the things they have no choice about, how do I understand the book? So what we've come to understand is if I take Rashi and I reorganize the book according to Rashi, I have a different book. If I follow the book, again, without getting into all the chapter numbers and so on, I have Matan Torah taking place, or the Ten Commandments taking place afterwards. The Jews said Naaseh v'Nishma before. I have the building of the Mishkan taking place after the sin of the golden calf. I look at the Ramban, all of that's inverted. I look at the Ramban, no. They said Naaseh v'Nishma after the Ten Commandments, after Parshat Mishpatim. The Mishkan, before there was a sin, or they were instructed before the sin of the golden calf. So I'm saying is that the texture of these books becomes very different books. So what you have then is, if I gave the example at the beginning of some kind of a canvas, you actually really, if you think about it, have at least three different canvases, unless you want other canvases for what I told you before about the Bechor Shor. The Chizkuni has his canvas, and Rashi has his canvas, and Ramban has his canvas. And basically when we learn Torah, maybe that's the surprise over here, is that time is something which is very interesting. But when we learn Torah, each of us end up painting our canvas. And we end up studying a canvas where time, that's why we had the introduction that we had, time is something which is interesting. Time doesn't always flow in the right way because that's not how we tell stories. And even the Ramban now, I'll go back and says, he's the one who admitted that's not how you tell stories. You tell stories in a way which doesn't always make sense because of the sequence, because sometimes you say, by the way, here, just a thought. Is it possible that the person you're going to end up marrying, you already met them long ago, but nothing happened at that point? So when you start telling the story about how you met them, that's not going to be the first part that you tell. You're going to be talking about something else completely. And then at some point, you say, oh yeah, by the way, you know what? We met each other at camp, or we met each other by something else long, long, long ago. But that doesn't make a difference. The sequence doesn't make a difference over here, because it's not how you tell stories. And as some of you know, the Torah is the best story that was ever told, and therefore doesn't always follow the proper sequence. So now going back to the question somebody asked me before class, do I remember which year you were in? Do you remember which year was the best? It all flows together, but it's been one great story. Thank you.